From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We are following the major winter storm that's bearing down in the Northeast. It could let loose with more than 2 feet of snow in major cities. And we're going to be checking in on the storm throughout the program.
Right now, let's get to India, where President Obama spent the day with Prime Minister Narendra Modi celebrating Republic Day. That is a major Indian holiday that goes back to 1950 and celebrates India's first democratic constitution. More than 125,000 people came out for the Republic Day parade today in New Delhi in the pouring rain. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley among them. He's traveling with President Obama, and he joins us from New Delhi. Scott, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Well, and we understand this was a huge security operation to have the president there amongst, it sounds like, more than 100,000 people. The rain was also unrelenting. Tell us more about the parade.
The Republic Day parade is really a spectacle. It's one part military display and another part, I don't know, Epcot Center. The military portion is sometimes likened to a Soviet parade with tanks and missile launchers rolling down the street, although I'm told it actually owes more to the British tradition, which I guess explains all those bagpipes. The Epcot portion then includes floats from many of the states of India as well as some government ministries. There was a float shaped like Mount Everest honoring a group of women military officers who scaled the summit. And there was a dance troupe that did a number celebrating India's successful effort to launch a satellite into orbit around Mars. So a little something for everyone.
Now, this is President Obama's second trip to India in his presidency. That is a first for a sitting U.S. president. What does this trip mean for President Obama and his presidency?
Yeah, it's a big deal to have a president visit twice. And the White House was actually surprised when the new prime minister here invited Obama to be the guest of honor at the parade. They took that as a signal that Prime Minister Modi is serious about fostering this relationship, and they didn't want to let the opportunity slip away. But what's interesting is the White House ordinarily downplays the role that personal chemistry plays in international relations. They'll say, oh, we can work with anybody as long as we have some shared interest, and especially if we have shared values. But the U.S. has had shared interest and shared values with India for a long time. Obama says theirs is a natural partnership, and yet for a long time, they didn't really progress, and that's partly because of India's entrenched bureaucracy. The U.S. believes Modi could be the agent who can change that.
Well, let's talk about substance here. They actually signed a long-delayed nuclear agreement yesterday, Prime Minister Modi and President Obama. Tell us about that and some of the other agenda items for these two leaders.
Yeah, that is really the big deliverable from this trip is the breakthrough on nuclear power. India could use more nuclear power. It's trying to provide electricity to hundreds of millions of Indians who don't now have it. But U.S. nuclear companies have been reluctant to get involved here because of an Indian law that makes them liable in the event of a nuclear accident. So the two governments think they've found a workaround for that, as well as for a disagreement over how to track nuclear material. And that could clear the way for more investment by U.S. firms. Now, the nuclear investment is one big ticket, but there are lots of ways that the U.S. would like to expand its trade to India. The trade picture has been growing, but it's still a really fairly small trading relationship given the size and the population of this country. Today, the president and the prime minister addressed a gathering of CEOs from both American and Indian firms. And President Obama said they're going to try hard to remove some of the roadblocks that have made trade so difficult.
Now, here in India, as the Prime Minister just discussed, there's still too many barriers, hoops to jump through, bureaucratic restrictions that make it hard to start a business or to export, to import, to close a deal, deliver on a deal. We hear this consistently from business leaders like you.
The president did talk about some concrete steps that the United States will be taking, including a push by the Export-Import Bank to finance more U.S. exports to India.
Scott Horsley, how is Pakistan feeling about this trip?
Threatened. How about that? Mm. And it's interesting. The headlines in Pakistan are critical. And, of course, not surprisingly, this is the usual pattern. The headlines here in India are the mirror image of that. India is fairly gleeful that its unfriendly neighbor is getting the short end of the stick. In the past, the White House has always tried to avoid antagonizing Pakistan. The last time President Obama came to India, he said he looked forward to visiting Pakistan as well. You are not, however, hearing that kind of pledge during this visit.
And as we know, the president had to cut short this visit to India. He was supposed to go to the Taj Mahal tomorrow, but instead is going to go to Saudi Arabia to pay tribute to King Abdullah, who died last week. What can we expect from his trip to Saudi Arabia?
The president will pay his respects to the royal family that's mourning King Abdullah's death, and he'll also meet with Abdullah's successor, the former Crown Prince Salman. It's not really clear how substantive their talks will be, although Salman has promised continuity, so we don't expect any big changes in Saudi Arabia. But the two leaders will likely have at least some chance to talk about regional concerns. That would include the ongoing fight with the Islamic State and certainly the recent unsettling developments in Saudi's next-door neighbor, Yemen.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley, who is traveling with the president in India and maybe thought he was going to be able to go to the Taj Mahal tomorrow, but instead will be heading to Saudi Arabia. Scott, thanks so much.
We have more now on the president's trip to India, specifically India under this new prime minister, Narendra Modi. Shumit Ganguly is a professor of political science and director of the Center for American and Global Security at Indiana University in Bloomington. Thanks a lot for being with us, Mr. Ganguly.
My pleasure.
We want to ask you first about the Prime Minister Modi. He has been in office less than a year. Would you characterize for us his relationship with the United States, specifically with President Obama, and why this relationship has been such a priority for both men?
Well, frankly, it comes as a surprise because, as you may recall, that Modi had actually been prevented from coming to the United States earlier because of certain allegations about his role in a set of riots that took place in February 2002 when he was the chief minister of a state in western India, Gujarat. But then the Supreme Court in India deemed that there was insufficient evidence to link him to the riots and thereby absolved him of all legal blame in the riots.
I mean, that's quite a turnaround from just about a year ago. It was within the past year that the U.S. revoked his passport to come to the U.S. And now we have the two leaders being very close and making great progress.
This is exactly right. So it's a most dramatic turnaround. And in considerable part, it has to do with three issues, I think, which both sides feel are important. Number one, obviously, India recognizes that it needs American investment. The U.S. sees enormous opportunities in India, despite the barriers that the president spoke of in the segment that you just played. Secondly, both sides are acutely concerned about the rise of China and about the uncertainty that surrounds the rise of China, about what kind of power will China be in Asia. And thereby, both India and the United States are keeping their powder dry. And here opens up the possibility of increased defense cooperation.
Okay, and
And the third area, I would say, is that India can play a critical role in climate change negotiations, which are looming before us in Paris. If the Indians prove to be recalcitrant, then I'm afraid any kind of a climate pact will be torpedoed from the very outset.
Okay, let's talk about climate change in just a minute. But getting back to defense, you talked about China's investment in defense in the region. Let's look at Russia as well. One of the agreements that's been made was the renewal of a 10-year defense pact between India and the U.S. India is the world's largest consumer of Russian arms, a very important factor, certainly for the United States. How does the U.S. Agreement with India affect the relationship both with India and Moscow and the U.S. and Moscow?
Well, India is increasingly trying to diversify its weapons purchases. And in fact, over the past several years, India has bought about $10 billion worth of American equipment. This was hitherto unprecedented because at the end of the Cold War, close to 70% of India's arsenal was of Soviet origin. And since then, India has been trying to move away, though it's very difficult to completely break that dependence on Russia because of the long prior relationship with the Soviet Union. But nevertheless, there is increasing interest in purchasing a number of important defense items from the United States. And I suspect under the aegis of this defense agreement, we will see further defense cooperation, military-to-military cooperation, greater American naval visits to India, and the actual purchase of American equipment.
When we talk about the U.S. alliance with India regarding the Indian nuclear weapons program, there are great concerns, as you know and as you've heard, about the safeguarding of nuclear weapons material and civilian uses for nuclear material. Where do those safeguards stand right now?
I think the Indians sought to reassure President Obama that they will have sufficient safeguards in place, that spent fuel from nuclear reactors cannot be, fall into the hands of unsavory characters or, worse still, terrorists. And in fact, just before Obama came, there was a good deal of discussion in the Indian press about the necessity of communicating to Obama in the most unequivocal terms that India is serious about the security of nuclear materials.
Okay.
And I think agreements were reached while the president was in town.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there because I just want to ask you very briefly before we have to close out for your reaction to what's happening in terms of climate change with India having some of the most polluted cities on Earth. What kind of security do you feel that India has made in terms of a commitment to reducing climate change?
Very quickly, I think India is going to invest a significant amount of money in solar energy, and that's why it's also turning to the United States, because it can buy solar panels from the United States. And there was a small irritant that the Indians wanted some domestic content included. It'll be interesting to see how that has been resolved in these meetings between Obama and Modi.
Okay, thank you. Shumit Ganguly is professor of political science and director of the Center on American and Global Security at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. Nice to have you on the program again.
Thank you.
Today, sheriffs who are meeting in Washington, D.C. asked for the traffic app Waze to disable a popular feature. It locates police on roadways. Sheriffs are concerned it leaves officers open to being targeted. The man who shot and killed two New York police officers last month posted a screenshot from Waze on his Instagram account. Meanwhile, after months of study and a meeting last week, police chiefs and mayors are calling for improvements in community policing. Karen Freeman Wilson is mayor of Gary, Indiana. She chaired the U.S. Conference of Mayors working group of mayors and police chiefs, and she joins us from Gary. Mayor, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, let me start by just defining the terms here. What does community policing mean to you?
For me, community policing means a way that law enforcement engages the community, not just when there is a crisis, but in their daily duties and in the day-to-day activities of law enforcement. So it is creating a connection. It's creating a relationship with members of the community, particularly the law-abiding citizens, so that when an incident occurs, they will have a connection that will give citizens the confidence that if they provide information, that it will be acted upon and that it will be held confidentially. It also gives citizens the confidence that when there is a crisis such as a police-involved death, that because the pre-existing relationship exists, they know that it will be investigated in a manner that will give, again, the community comfort in knowing that anyone that has done wrong, if it's found to be a wrongful shooting, will be addressed.
And how common is this around the country at this point?
The practice of community-oriented policing is very common. And in fact, increasingly, police departments are training, are encouraging all of their officers. And what you're seeing is that initially there was a program. It was called the COPS program, community-oriented policing. You would have one or two or maybe three or four officers whose job it was to go into the community and connect with citizens. Now, police departments, large and small, are understanding that that has to be the normal protocol, that people are wanting to have relationships with the police department that is not necessarily related to a call, and that it benefits officers to have a connection to the community that supersedes any specific law enforcement activity.
Can it work, though, in an era of budget cuts, in an era where police departments and cities in general have had to cut back because of the economy?
In fact, it can work in an era of tighter budgets. Tighter budgets should really drive more departments to engage in community-oriented policing, because you don't have as many officers on the street. You don't have some of the resources that you have traditionally had. So it's important that you have a relationship with the law-abiding members of the community. It's important that there is a connection that would cause people to call the police when there is a problem. So I think that the tighter budgets really make the case for the importance of community-oriented policing.
Mayor Freeman Wilson, I want to play a little bit of tape from a segment on 60 Minutes on CBS last night. They were looking into this very issue in Cleveland, where the police department has been under federal investigation. The police there had shot and killed a 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was carrying and playing with a toy gun. And CBS correspondent Bill Whitaker took two white police officers to a community center to interact with folks there. Let's listen.
What is the perception of the police?
In this neighborhood, it's not that good. Some people get that badge on their chest and they think they become Superman. They got a right to take on the world.
How do you differentiate these kids from the ones you call the bad guys?
One of the things is probably a smile and a wave and how you doing, officer, instead of spitting.
So you hear there, these officers who, by the way, completely agree with your idea that there be more interaction just on a regular basis between police and the members of the community that they are policing. But as you can hear there, many of the residents don't feel that kind of trust that you're talking about with the police force.
Well, and we saw that in the Zogby poll that was conducted by the U.S. Conference of Mayors. There is a gap in the confidence that African Americans have in police officers versus Latinos and Caucasian citizens. But what we do understand is that the overwhelming majority of all citizens do trust police officers. And I think what people often forget, and I learned this as a deputy prosecutor a long, long time ago, is that as a rule, African Americans tend to be more law and order than a lot of people think. And so we want the police to, in fact, engage in our communities. We count on that to happen. It's a matter of how it happens and the approach that they take. I think it also goes to recruiting. It also goes to training. And it also goes to discipline of officers. And so that's an important aspect of our findings and an important aspect of really addressing the concerns in the community.
What did police chiefs in your working group have to say about all this?
Well, police chiefs in our working group, and, you know, we had veteran police chiefs and commissioners like Commissioner Ramsey out of Philadelphia, they wanted to really emphasize the fact that community policing can't be a program. It can't be one or two officers. It really does have to be a way of doing business in your department. And that's what they emphasized more than anything. They did also emphasize, and we agreed with them wholeheartedly, is that the work has to be done prior to the crises, because, you know, they are making life or death decisions. And just as the community has to have a level of confidence that the police will engage in their duties of protecting and serving in a constitutional manner, the families of these police officers have the right to expect that when they leave every morning or every evening or whenever their shift starts, that they will come back through the door at the end of that shift.
That's Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson of Gary, Indiana. She chaired the U.S. Conference of Mayors Working Group of Mayors and Police Chiefs. We'll link you to more from that working group at our website, hereandnow.org. Mayor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to check in on the blizzard now that's poised to strike much of the Northeast today. In New York, Governor Cuomo has declared a state of emergency. He says that public transportation will be limited as of 7 o'clock tonight. In Massachusetts and Connecticut, there will be travel bans starting tonight. The MBTA in Boston is going to shut down tonight and be closed all day tomorrow. Logan Airport in Boston has canceled all flights after 7 o'clock tonight. Forecasters say this storm could dump 2 to 3 feet of snow across the area. With us from the summit of Mount Washington in New Hampshire is Caleb Mute, weather observer and education specialist at the Mount Washington Observatory in New Hampshire. What's your altitude, Caleb?
We are elevated 6,288 feet above sea level up here.
Okay, so you have a pretty good, well, how is the view actually?
It's phenomenal. Right now we're actually in the clear up here, so we can our visibility is maxed out at the moment at 130 miles.
And how do you expect,
quite far.
How do you expect that to change given all you know up there?
Well, it's going to deteriorate quite fast overnight. Now, we can expect once the heavy snow gets in here, we have our winds getting up to the 60 to 80 mile per hour range with 105 mile per hour gusts. We're expecting that visibility really to go down to, 25 to 50 feet, even less at times when it's really bad up here.
And how does that compare with previous blizzard conditions you've seen previously?
Well, up here on the summit of Mount Washington, we do get conditions like this actually pretty frequently. Generally, when we have snowstorms that come through, our winds are usually well over around hurricane force. So, with the blowing snow, with the heavy falling snow, we're usually in the fog. So generally, our visibility is quite bad up here anyway. We're definitely going to be as bad as it usually is, maybe a little bit worse at times. It could get, 10 feet. It's certainly not going to be good at all.
Okay, so when you say hurricane force, you predict that for this storm, 105 miles an hour, maybe at its peak. What is hurricane force?
Hurricane force would be 75 miles per hour. Yes, we're predicting right now to be in the 60 to 80 mile per hour sustained wind range, and we're expecting them to gust up to 105 miles per hour at points during the storm.
So talk about batting down the hatches. What do you do to prepare and basically stay in one place?
Well, yeah, up here we're actually pretty well prepared for conditions like this. This observatory is definitely very foundationally sound up here, that's for sure. Up here in the winter, we get hurricane force winds every couple of days. And 100 mile per hour winds at least once per shift usually. So that's usually once every 8 days. So we are very well prepared for winds of that magnitude for sure.
Okay, so your shifts go 8 days. You have a chef up there. You have an IT specialist, a couple of interns, I guess, right?
Uh-huh.
What are you worried about? Doesn't sound like you're worried about too much. It sounds like you're anticipating it.
Yeah, we really aren't worried about a whole lot up here. It's really this areas at sea level, areas not at the high elevations that are really going to be getting the worst of this, I guess, because we're definitely prepared for it up here for sure.
Okay, so sea level, which particular areas are you looking at?
Well, definitely areas in southern New Hampshire, Massachusetts. There's blizzard warnings from central and northern New Jersey all the way up through northern Maine. So falling snow quite heavily, blowing snow, limiting visibility to less than a half a mile. And winds above 35 miles per hour sustained that or just gusting to that frequently. They can expect that. So actually in Massachusetts, and southern New Hampshire, they're looking at 2 to 3 feet possible with this storm. Certainly a lot of snow will fall with this.
Okay. And when do you expect it to be over?
Pretty much Tuesday night is when it's going to start to be winding down. Really, it's going to be moving off the coast. We will probably have some lingering snow showers in New England, especially northern New England, Tuesday night through Wednesday morning. But really the worst of it, the heaviest of the snowfall will be Tuesday during the morning and early afternoon hours. And then after that, it should start to wind down a little bit for us.
Okay. Caleb Mute from the top of Mount Washington and the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Hang on tight, Caleb.
I will do.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The world of social media is our focus on Mondays as we look at how the news has been playing online. Our go-to guide today, Julia Turner, editor-in-chief of Slate. Julia, one word, snow. How is this incoming blizzard playing on social media?
Well, there's sort of a few different aspects here. One, we're seeing the hashtag Snowmageddon 2015 trending online, which someone pointed out that if you have to attach a year to the word Snowmageddon, maybe Armageddon isn't the appropriate metaphor for the blizzard, but it does sound as though we're in for a pretty severe storm. And one thing that I've really enjoyed about weather on social media these days is the rise of what people sometimes call weather Twitter. And I think in part what we're seeing here is that a lot of the data around storms storms and storm tracking is more widely available so that you can have individual commentators arise to interpret it and help bring readers alternate perspectives beyond just what the nightly news or the Weather Channel is saying.
In Arizona, they're not really thinking too much about this mega apocalyptic, whatever they're saying, 2015 snowstorm. Instead, they're talking about Super Bowl. And so so let's go there. There's an ad that's going to be on the Sports Illustrated website as of Thursday, I believe, pre-Super Bowl ad that discusses the issue of domestic violence. And the voiceover, as you hear, is pretty clear on what the message is. Let's listen.
Let's take domestic violence out of football, paid for by Ultraviolet.
So what we're seeing is a football player in his gear. You see him running, and then the camera pans to a young woman standing in the middle of the field, and he tackles her to the ground. And the hashtag to this ad is Goodell must go, speaking of Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner. What do you hear in this ad?
Well, it's a really interesting effort to shift the conversation around advertising, you know, a medium about conveying messages, and use it to try and send a message to the NFL commissioner, suggesting that the NFL does not take accusations of domestic violence against its players seriously enough.
And by the way, do ads like this cause much controversy? Do they get noticed when they appear online? I mean, this is not an ad that's going to be on the Super Bowl.
Well, it's certainly a time of year at which ads get passed around, so I think it's probably a smart move to try and insert an ad into the conversation, and here we are talking about it right now, so it seems somewhat effective at least.
Okay, there's one more to talk about, a much lighter ad. This one features not quite Marsha Brady and not quite a Marsha Brady look-alike, but a big burly man with a tattooed chest sitting at his vanity pretending to be Marsha Brady, brushing her hair and counting the brush strokes. Let's listen to this one.
103. 104.
Marsha.
105. 106.
Marsha.
Shut up, Mom! 1, 2.
It's not completely clear, at least from the audio version, what this is all about, but this is sponsored by Snickers. What's going on here?
Well, it's not just any burly man. It's Danny Trejo, the wonderful character actor who's appeared in a number of Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino movies. The idea of the campaign is that when you're hungry, you become so enraged that you desperately need a Snickers. But it's an interesting moment. I think the Bradys have been in circulation this month. The Brady Bunch movies were on Netflix recently. And, you know, sometimes it feels like, really? We're still talking about the Brady Bunch in 2015? On the other hand, maybe it's kind of nice that we're not all so pegged towards the new that interesting bits of cultural ephemera can get their day in the sun again.
Even in newish media.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, Julia Turner, editor-in-chief of Slate. Thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me.
New Hampshire has a problem that a lot of states have. It's got an aging population and is having trouble convincing its young people to move back home after college. Of course, the promise of jobs can be an incentive. But in Somersworth, New Hampshire, some are drawn back by a sense of community. Emily Corwin from Here and Now contributing station New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
Somersworth, New Hampshire is a small city about an hour and a half north of Boston. How small? Well, it's got a couple pizza parlors, a pawn shop, a thrift store, and like a lot of New England mill towns, that's about it. Most days, the river is the liveliest thing in town. Now imagine you grew up here. You're 20-something. You just got a master's degree from Harvard. Do you really want to move back?
You come home after college, and you sort of don't feel like you're doing all that you can do to be the successful person that you set out to be.
27-year-old Maddie DeSantis moved back to Somersworth from Boston 4 years ago and found a job working for New Hampshire Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. She says leaving the big city for this sleepy little town was not an obvious choice.
You know, the fear of missing out, you know, hashtag FOMO, it saturates everything, but I'm here to tell you that it is the coolest thing you can do.
Today, DeSantis is a bona fide Somersworth booster. She even serves on the city's historic district commission. And she's not the only 20-something to start investing in this city of 12,000. DeSantis says 8 childhood friends who grew up near their neighborhood elementary school also moved back to Somersworth after college. This guy is one of them.
My name's Emmett Soldati. I'm one of the co-owners of Levin Beer and Bread House.
Soldati returned to Somersworth 3 years ago after studying in London. He says he and his friends realized if they wanted a hip place to go after work and on the weekends, they'd have to build it themselves.
Two of my friends that I have known from childhood, Aiden and Patrick, they wanted to open up a bar. I kind of always wanted to open up a sourdough bread bakery. we put the two together and opened Levin.
This brew pub is Soldati's second startup in Somersworth. 2 years ago, he opened a tea and pastry shop called Teetotaler. Soldati's two businesses employ about 14 people. He says he wants to see Somersworth thrive.
That was a very infectious feeling. And since then, you know, it's no longer about, oh, I'll do this for a little while and then move on. It's sort of, what's the next project? What's the next business? You know, where do we go from here?
New Hampshire is a state awash in baby boomers. It's suffering a serious case of brain drain. Students leave for college and don't come back. You've got to wonder, is Somersworth doing something right? Does it have high-paying employers or special tax incentives? Somersworth Economic Development Director Christine Suter says, not really.
I say it's great happenstance. You know, it has to come from them. All I can do is say thank you and I support you.
Suter says when the mills started closing at the turn of the 20th century, Somersworth struggled economically. Now she says that may be changing.
Not only is it things that are happening in the evenings, but it's fun, it's music, it's young people, it's quality. It's quality.
Maddie DeSantis says she, Soldati, and their friends explicitly chose Somersworth over big cities like Boston or Washington, D.C. And she says they didn't do it for jobs or free rent at their parents' houses. They did it for each other.
I had a best friend that grew up there as we turn the corner here.
In her Chevy Malibu, DeSantis drives me around the neighborhood she and her 12 best friends grew up in. They stayed in touch through college, and 8 of them moved back. Now, even more young people are moving to Somersworth from surrounding towns.
See, I think Somersworth is pretty unique.
Kate Lusko runs a nonprofit in New Hampshire called Stay Work Play. It's dedicated to attracting more young people to the state.
The momentum that's happening with these younger people who grew up there, decided to go out and see the world, and are coming back to make Somersworth, I guess, more of what they would like to see and more of what they would like their future to be. I'm trying to think of other spots in New Hampshire, and I really can't think of anywhere.
Lusko says she doesn't know of any other town with a story quite like Somersworth's, but she's not surprised.
Young people naturally look for community. I think especially when you're in your 20s, you're trying to figure out where you fit in the world. And so you want to find other people that are also trying to figure out where they fit and who may be looking for the same things that you are.
DeSantis agrees. She says having her peers here is why she's putting down roots.
All of a sudden, all my friends, my high school friends and my childhood friends were back. All of them. All of them all at the same time. And it was like, but everyone's here. I don't want to go. When every single person you love is not just in the same town, but within 5 homes of one another. It was like, yeah, I'm going to stay here.
So will this idealistic community forged through childhood friendships translate into lasting change for Somersworth? Well, we'll be watching. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Corwin in New Hampshire.